Well, you join us here at a packed Murrayfield where the score is Scotland 9 points, England 6, and at the moment Scotland have a line-out just on the English 22 to be taken by McManus, and he'll be aiming for the tall frame of Jamie Johnson, this big strapping 6'3", 19.5 stones policeman from Hoyk. And McManus throws in, it's palmed back by the enormous Johnston to Gordon Craig, the 18.5 stones solicitor from Kelso. He feeds it to Lennox, this mountainous 6'5" worth of doctor from Fife to Gimmel, and he storms forwards, the English pack being scattered by 19 stones of rampaging Edinburgh dentist. And now the ball is with Kerr, the massive teacher from Gala Shields, to Mowbray, the 6'8" gynecologist, to Renfrew, the 18 stone magistrate, and finally to Steele, who's neither very big nor from the professions. So it's a mystery how he was picked for this team at all. I think that's one the selectors will have to look at again for the next match, and possibly look to replace him with Archie Maynard, the 6'9", 19 stones customs inspector from Inverness, who's head of my Masonic lodge. And now both sets of forwards are really going at each other, and there's a bit of a tussle down there. Not a fight, you understand. We don't have fights in rugby union. Just tussles. Fights only happen in rugby league. That vulgar association football. A game where violence is only too commonplace. And there's a slight pause in play now as the England trainer attempts to staunch the flow of blood from the aortic artery of his experienced number 8. But that boy's a big, tough army PE instructor from Truro, and it'll take more than a dagger through the neck to get him to come off. The referee, Thomas Jones, this no-nonsense architect from Llanelli, is having a chat now with the Scottish number 8 about that tussle. No doubt telling him in no uncertain terms that if there's any more stabbing in the rucks, then England will be given a penalty. That's the kind of strict disciplinary control that rugby referees exert. And as the whistle blows for half-time, I hand you back to a 6'2" former disc jockey from Penge.
Time for the Million Pound Radio Show, so please welcome your host, Andy Hamilton.
Thank you, and welcome to the show. Andy, sorry,
we're going to have to do the start again.
What?
He read it wrong, he missed my name off. But guys, can we go for the SIG tune again, Andy?
Didn't you get the letter?
What letter?
Oh, God. They said they'd send you a letter. You should have had a letter. You've been laid off.
What?
Yeah, it's no reflection on you, Nick. John Harvey Jones did his cost efficiency report and, you know.
Oh, I see.
I'm so sorry.
Right. So, you haven't been sacked then?
No.
How come?
I don't know. I suppose they figured it was cheaper, you know, to pay me half as much again than to pay both of us a fee each.
Right. So when did all this happen then?
Oh, the other week, John Harvey Jones came in, looked at the show, decided we needed to lose a cast member, and so we had a vote, and you were it.
A vote?
Yeah.
Well, who voted?
Well, the people in the show.
Well, that's me and you.
But
I never voted because I never knew about it.
Well, that is scandalous. Honestly, the lines of communication in this place, eh?
So this vote?
Yeah, it was a secret ballot, yeah. Obviously, I can't tell you which way I voted, no. You know, but...
Obviously, I realised that. Hang on, just let me think
and
about
listen,
this.
Listen, mate, we are also sorry to lose you, you know. In fact, we've written this leaving card for you.
Uh-huh. Okay,
people have put some really funny messages on it. You know, like, Paul, the producer, he's put, "You're redundant. Ha ha. Ha ha." And look, there's a drawing of two fingers there the PA. Yeah. Oh, and I nearly forgot, right? There's a farewell party for you at the BBC Club after the show.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Yep. Everyone's going to be there. There's lots of champagne in the fridge already, apparently. Should be a great day.
Oh, well, that's something. I'll look forward to that.
Yeah, you won't be able to come, mate.
Eh?
No, well, you know how tight security is at the moment, and with you not being employed officially by the BBC anymore, I mean, you know,
oh,
sort
of, right.
Well, yeah, sorry.
I understand. That's fine. Really, that's fine. Well, I'll be off then. See ya.
Well, look, Nick, this is choking me up, mate. Now that you're here, why don't you do the show anyway?
Well, no, I couldn't, you know.
Please.
Well, will I get paid?
Well, the money best be paid to me because of all the red tape, obviously.
Oh, right, what, and then you give me half later? Oh, brilliant, Andy. You're
well, we'll talk about that afterwards.
Sure.
We'll sort it out.
Well, we interrupt the £1 million radio show there just to give us all a chance to reflect on how incredibly stupid the one with the big nose is. So, meanwhile, let's enjoy our Radio 4 thriller, The Silence of the Sheep. A chilling journey into the nightmare world of a psychotic.
Now remember, this man is an animal, okay? Don't take any chances with him, understand?
Understand.
We'll be outside if you need us.
Who are you?
My name's Sarah.
Do you know who I am, Sarah? Do you know what I've done?
Yes.
And you dare to be in this cell with me? I've murdered countless victims. I've eaten human flesh. I'm a demon from the darkest side of hell, and that is why they've locked me away in this fortress. That's why they make me wear this muzzle. Because I am amoral, barbaric, and most of all, lethal. Why have you come?
Because I have some news. We're going to return you into the community.
What?
We're going to return you into the community. I'm part of a Home Office unit that's launching a new drive away from institutionalizing people and returning them into the normalizing environment of the community.
You're going to set me free? To run loose?
Well, once a week you'll have to report to a day center.
A day center?
Yes, where you can do some occupational therapy. You know, something relaxing like making pots.
I don't make pots. I put people in pots. Besides, if I start doing pottery, the other serial killers will laugh at me.
Now, don't be silly. Take off this stupid muzzle and let's get you into some fresh air.
But I'm mentally ill.
I'm sorry, but under this government, we don't class people as mentally ill anymore. We just say they're having a bad day. Come on, dear.
Don't call me dear. I won't leave. I know what you're up to. You want to turn me into one of those poor, sad creatures who wander up and down the high street all day muttering and shouting Antichrist at people coming out of the post office.
That's right. Here's your bobble hat. Huh? And some string to wear as a belt. And odd shoes, one with the toe flapping loose.
Oh.
Right, now come along.
But get away from me.
You love it out there. All that camaraderie, sleeping in boxes under railway arches. It'll be like camping. And the Sally Army bring round soup. And check if you need any delousing powder, or if you've gone blue from hypothermia. Now, come along, out you go.
No, I won't go.
Dear, oh dear, come on. Out you go.
Don't make me go. Don't make me go.
Well, we've had to interrupt that item as the switchboard's been jammed by listeners complaining that they were shocked and disturbed by the psychotic and sadistic behaviour of the government official.
By the way, how's it going with that grumpy neighbour of yours?
Oh, didn't I tell you? They buried him last week.
He died?
No, the kids buried him. he fell asleep in his garden and the kids buried him.
Well, didn't he notice?
Well, apparently he says he started shouting, but no one heard him over the noise of the mechanical digger. You know?
Pitt was driving a digger?
No, Robbie was driving the digger. No, Pitt was pouring in the cement.
They play together really well, don't they?
Yes, nice. Things. You know, they get on, yeah. Now, earlier this year, the British Olympic Committee chose Manchester rather than London to go forward as the British nomination to host the Olympics in 1996. Now, why didn't London get the vote? Sir Hector Topliss, you were in charge of London's bid. Why not London?
Well, why not indeed? I find the whole decision mystifying.
Right. Now, I suppose a lot of people might feel that London wouldn't be able to cope with an event on the scale of the Olympics. Many Londoners, for instance, would raise questions about public transport in the capital.
What about public transport in London?
Well, we'd like some.
Well, there you are. The Olympics would have provided the perfect opportunity to create a superb transport system and invest in marvellous sporting facilities. I mean, look, I've got the plans here. See, fantastic new stadium, marvellous all-weather venue for rowing.
That's the sewers, isn't it?
The perfect indoor water sports centre. Unless it rains heavily, of course, in which case competitors would just have to mind their heads.
But what about the health factors? I mean, wouldn't synchronised swimmers be at risk from lethal disease?
Yes, there's that advantage as well. I mean... No, the BOC opted for Manchester.
Right, now, Princess Anne, you were on that committee. Why was London rejected?
Lots of factors, really. But I think the overriding consideration was that one didn't want millions more tourists scorping through the railings at Mum's house.
Any more general factors?
Well, London's written submission was a little thin on detail. For instance, next to the question, where would the athletes be accommodated, they'd written, we'll put them up with friends. Also, we felt that the title of their prospectus, The London Olympics, A Nice Little Learner, was not quite an Olympic spirit. Plus, there were general concerns about London's infrastructure, its roads...
And its architecture. Dreadful carbuncles everywhere. Disgraceful.
Yes, Charles, it's all right. Sorry about that. I'm looking after him while Diana's away.
Sir Harry Melchett, now, you were part of the successful Manchester bid. What do you think tipped it your way?
Well, basically, I think the committee felt it didn't want millions of foreigners coming to this country and immediately encountering a bunch of southern puffs. Let's face it, people up north are much more genuine. It's a well-known fact, so all in all...
I resent this. Our bid was headed by Sebastian Coe, one of the world's greatest runners.
Ah, well, round our way, you'd have to be a great runner with a name like Sebastian.
It's Seb Coe on our team.
Seb Coe? That namby-pamby streak of... piss?
Yeah.
We have Bobby Charlton! Bobby Charlton!
Please, can we just keep this discussion civilised, okay?
Go on, knock him!
No, Your Highness, please. Don't get involved, please, Your Highness. Look, we cannot have fighting in the studio, okay?
I blame the teachers.
Yes, all right, thank you. Thank you, Prince Charles. Yeah, look, please, let's get out of this.
Well, we interrupt this programme for an important newsflash. The Prime Minister, John Major, has just announced his resignation. The Conservative Party have voted unanimously for the reinstatement of Margaret Thatcher, who now returns as British Prime Minister. No, it's okay, we're only kidding. But we had you going there, didn't we? Well, we can now return you to the £1 million radio show, but we're not going to. Instead, we bring you episode 2 of our adventure series set in the Wild West, the Santa Fe Trail.
Okay, Mrs. Jones. Now, the Cherokee have massacred half the wagon train, and I reckon they'll be looking for us once dawn comes up. Now, your baby is on its way. Now, I know you're a brave woman, and that you and the baby are going to pull through, okay?
Hold my hand, husband. Okay.
Okay, now, Mrs. Jones. When the pain gets too much, just bite on this Bowie knife, okay?
No, actually, if you don't mind awfully, I think we'll do without the Bowie knife. Thank you all the same.
What?
Well, it's just that at the antenatal classes, my wife decided she'd like to have a natural labour without any pain relief. Isn't that right, dear? So if we could dispense with the knife between the teeth.
I want it.
June, we agreed, didn't we? Now, what is the point of having a birth plan if we don't stick to it? That's what I've always said.
Mr. Jones, if your wife screams with pain, then the Cherokee will hear and we will all be wiped out. Your wife wants to bite on the knife, and I'm responsible for the safety of everyone on this wagon train, and I say she bites on that knife.
I see. So the father has no rights at the birth of his child. Well, that's very nice.
Look, if you want to make yourself useful while I deliver the baby, you keep an eye out for Cherokees with my Smith & Wesson.
I'd rather not, if you don't mind. I'm anti-firearms.
Okay, suit yourself. Now, Mrs. Jones, you're doing fine. I'm going to give you a little whiskey to dull the pain.
You are not.
Mr. Jones.
Oh, I'm sorry, but it's not fair on the baby, is it, dear?
She doesn't seem very relaxed, does she? Tell you what.
What?
You massage her shoulders, I'll fetch my harp.
Harp?
For the sake, man, are you mad? You get us all scalped!
Well, really, I shall be billing you for damage to my harp.
We are surrounded by hostile Indians who might just detect the sound of a harp.
Maybe so, but I'm a firm believer in not letting others set one's agenda. And if June needs relaxing, then...
Shh. Listen. The Cherokee, they're having a war dance.
Right.
Where are you going?
To complain about the noise. I mean, fancy starting up at this time of night, you know.
He's going to see the Indians. I don't believe it.
Husband!
No, June. It's not the volume, June. It's the principle. No consideration for other some people. Don't worry. I'll be back in half an hour. As soon as I...
You shot my husband.
I'm afraid so, Mrs. Jones. I had no choice.
Is he dead?
I reckon so.
Well, shoot him again just to make sure. Well, next week you can hear episode 3 of the Santa Fe Trail, where Mrs. Jones's new baby is stolen by the Cherokee and raised as an Indian brave called Little Nerd Whinging. But now it's back to 2 more little nerds whinging.
Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, there was a message for you. Kitty rang.
All right, cheers, thanks.
So who's Kitty?
Oh, Kitty Kelly.
What, the Kitty Kelly? That woman who wrote the demolition job on Nancy Reagan?
Yeah, she's rung me a couple of times this week, yeah.
Oh, I've read that book, you know. Yeah. She digs up some really scabrous details about Nancy. Portrays her as a total monster. Yeah. It's just complete character assassination.
Yeah.
So what's Kitty Kelly been phoning you about?
Oh, nothing. She just wanted to ask me some questions about you.
About me?
Yeah.
What sort of questions?
Oh, just trivial stuff.
Well, why was she asking questions about me?
Well, I don't know. I didn't ask.
You didn't ask?
Well, it's none of my business, Nick. There's probably some perfectly innocent explanation.
She didn't ask you lots of questions about my childhood, did she?
No, no, no. She said she got all that stuff from your mum.
Mum?
Yeah, said your mum was really helpful. Sent her photos, press clippings, psychiatric reports, the lot, yeah.
What did you tell her?
Nothing, all right? Don't worry. She did ask me a question, and I said, look, Kitty, it's no good asking me that. I wouldn't dream of commenting. That's a private matter, strictly between Nick and his venereologist, you know.
She must be writing a book about me. But why?
Well, it's obvious, isn't it, Nick? I mean, she writes books about famous celebrities, like Sinatra and Nancy Reagan. Yeah. So obviously she wants to write a book about you because she wants the creative challenge of writing about a complete nobody and seeing if she can make it interesting, you know.
Andy, I'm feeling really anxious about all this.
Well, listen, Nick, don't panic. Take it easy. Why don't you talk it through with your therapist at your next visit?
Yeah, good idea. She'll make sense of it. Oh, she's really helpful.
Yeah, that's what Kitty Kelly said.
What?
Nothing. Well, anyway, listeners, now you may know that the TV series Bergerac is soon to be discontinued. But we're very pleased to say that we have bought the radio rights. So here is Bergerac on the radio.
Jim, can I have a word?
Sure.
Some good news, Jim. It's just come through. You've been promoted to Chief Inspector. Congratulations.
Thanks, Barney. Chief Inspector?
Yeah.
And what's more, Head Office are putting you in charge of a new manor.
Great. Where?
Scunthorpe.
Scunthorpe.
Something's the matter, Jim?
It's just, well, Scunthorpe's not exactly glamorous. I mean, I'm used to chasing criminals across nice golden beaches, drinking cocktails in luxury seaside hotels, driving down flowering country lanes in my vintage sports car, mixing with high society.
Head Office are aware of that, Jim, but they've decided to transfer you to Scunthorpe for one basic reason.
What's that?
Spite. They're fed up with you gallivanting around beauty spots and shafting glamorous jewel thieves. So I'm afraid you're Scunthorpe bound.
Oh, I see. Well, so long, Barney. I'll miss the old place.
Well, we won't miss you, Jim. You've always got right up our nose. I think what annoyed us most is the way every crime committed on Jersey seemed to involve your bloody ex-father-in-law. We're sending him to Scunthorpe as well. In a box.
Right, well, goodbye, Barney.
Before you go, Jim, me and the rest of the lads wanted you to have this going away present.
What is it?
It's your vintage sports car. We put it through the crusher. Doesn't look so flash now, does it? Bye, Jim.
Are It's time now for our prestigious Golden Boot Award, which we give each year to the footballer who we feel has scored the most spectacular goal of the season. And this year, to judge the finalists, we have ex-England international and West Ham favourite, Trevor Brooking. Welcome, Trevor.
Well, thank you, Andy. Nice to be here.
Right, now let's just remind listeners of the three finalists, and they are... Paul Gascoigne for his stunning 30-yarder in the Cup semi-final against Arsenal. Mark Hughes for his marvellous lob for Man United against Derby County at Old Trafford. And finally, me, for my cracking volley against the Turkish language students up Holland Park, coolly taken under pressure from the big fat bloke who works part-time in the laundrette. So, Trevor, a difficult choice. Which goal wins this Golden Boot?
Well, it wasn't easy, Andy, but in the end I've gone for Mark Hughes' marvellous lob against Derby County.
Right. So, Mark Hughes wins the Golden Boot for his superb, if slightly fortunate, lob against Derby County. And now I would ask Mark Hughes to step up out of our audience and accept this Golden Boot. Mark, congratulations. Now, what do you remember about that goal?
Well, it was a great build-up. Terrific through ball by Brown Robson. I was very pleased with the lob because it was from a very difficult angle.
Absolutely, yes. Of course, it was helped by the fact that you had proper football boots on.
Sorry?
Well, you had proper boots on, whereas I was playing in some old trainers I borrowed from Libby. You know, I mean, I was slipping around a bit, you know.
Yeah, but Andy, that doesn't change the fact it was a very skillful lob by Mark. Mm-hmm. The ball came to him at an awkward height, he controlled it.
Without a Jack Russell yapping at his heels.
What?
Well, I had that stupid Jack Russell up the park trying to get the ball as I controlled it.
Well, I may not have had a Jack Russell trying to get the ball off me, but there were two Derby County defenders.
Oh, come on, there's no comparison. I mean, five Derby County defenders don't equal one Jack Russell, do they?
Well, what about the finish, Andy? You can't argue with that. It was a superbly judged lob.
True. Mind you, a lob's a pretty sissy way of scoring a goal, isn't it?
Oh, for goodness sake.
I thumped mine between those coats, left the keeper floundering, and that Turkish language student's a good goalie. He's got his own gloves and everything, you know. He's good.
Look, I was invited to judge on the best goal. I've done that. I've repeatedly watched videos of the goals scored by Gazza and Yuzi. I've read the written account of yours several times. Watched the Instamatic snapshots on the Flickbook. And I've decided on the Mark Hughes goal, all right?
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's no surprise you chose the lob. That's the namby-pamby sort of way you used to score goals, isn't it, Trev? Or should I call you Pussyfoot?
Oh, I've had enough of this.
Me too.
Oh, yeah, the truth hurts, eh? Yeah.
Andy.
What?
That was embarrassing.
I know, these football experts know bugger all. They chose Mark Hughes' goal. Yeah.
No, I mean, you were embarrassing. When are you going to give up this absurd notion that you're a professional standard footballer?
I could have been a footballer, okay?
Sabutio, maybe.
Look, come on. Why not? Give me one good reason.
Well, for a start, you're tiny. You're the only player I've seen who has to stand on a stool to head the ball.
Look, it is not size that's important, it's skill. That's what's wrong with English football. Artists like me and Glenn Hoddle have been forced out of the game. I was saying to Liam Brady...
Well, while Andy takes a one-way trip to Fantasy Island, we'll leave him there. And now...
And you don't get...
The Million Pound Radio Show, in association with Sex Talk, the 0898 number that rings you up and says, I'm 19, slim and sexy, but tough, you're old and fat, brings you the truth behind money.
Money. Humans will do anything for money. They will work, sell, steal, cheat, and force their hands into unnatural positions down the backs of sofas. Examples of primitive money have been found all over the world, but the largest ever hoard of prehistoric coins was found in 1987 under Ken Dodd's mattress. Archaeological digs have also revealed that in early Roman times, livestock was bartered as currency.
Pint of Frascati, please.
That'll be half a calf, please.
Right, where's me wallet? There you are, one Frisian bull.
Oh, haven't you got anything smaller?
No. I'm sorry, it's either that or an Aberdeen Angus.
All right. But I'll have to give you the change in poultry, I'm afraid, all right?
Oh, no! Chickens are so fiddly. And they peck holes in your pockets.
All right. Look. Hey, can anyone change 9 chickens for a sheep or 2.5 pigs?
No, I've got some pigs.
All right, then, pigs, yeah.
Well, hang on, hang on. That pig's an albino. I'm not having a white pig. The shops won't accept them.
It's still legal tender. Now, be off with you.
Here, landlord.
Oh, what is it now?
There's an hedgehog stuck in the slot machine.
Oh, bloody or not. I've told you before, it doesn't take hedgehogs, all right?
In the centuries that followed, money became one of the main driving forces behind civilization. A multinational bank was formed to look after the money of poor people. It was called the Catholic Church. And in Elizabethan Britain, explorers and buccaneers carved out trading routes to virgin lands.
My Lord Raleigh, what treasures have you brought back from the New World?
Ma'am, I have brought you this, the potato, a most flavoursome and congenial vegetable. And this, tobacco, a soothing plant when smoked. And finally, I have returned with this.
And what is that called?
Syphilis.
And what's it for?
It's a sort of conversation piece, ma'am.
You have done well, Raleigh. Have these goods taken to my treasury. Then return to the high seas and plunder yet more booty for your queen.
I was wondering, Great Majesty, if I might not receive some royal reward for my pains as an incentive?
Why, of course, Raleigh. And your incentive shall be keeping your head attached to your shoulders.
Sounds fair enough to me.
The rapacious system of capitalism quickly grew to engulf the globe. Moralists and writers began to question the new materialism. Shakespeare wrote the famous lines, "All that glisters is not gold," which has since become the company slogan for ratners. It was during the 19th century that psychologists started to comment on the mental link we seem to make between money and excrement. Witness familiar conversational expressions like rolling in it, filthy lucre, stinking rich, and that crap merchant Geoffrey Archer. In 1867, Karl Marx wrote Das Kapital and changed our thinking about money. He proposed a system for distributing wealth which was logical, fair, and didn't work. Socialism was a system which was to condemn millions of idealists to a life standing outside supermarkets, selling newspapers, and yelling through megaphones. So, money has become the motivating force in all our lives. Money can be the root of all evil. It can be the spur for ambition. It can be an excuse for a very irritating song by ABBA. We all need money to live, including BBC announcers who are supposed to get by on a wage that makes a church mouse look like the Sultan of Brunei. And that is the truth behind money.
Well, that's all for this week. Next week, Lady Porter, Lord Mayor of London, will be talking about how upsetting she finds the sight of thousands of people living on the streets of London in cardboard boxes and not paying any rent.
Lady Porter as Lord Mayor of London, eh?
Yeah, I know. I bet Dick Whittington's turning in his grave.
Yeah, yeah. If he's still got a grave, she's probably flogged it by now. So, listeners, that is all for this week. Good night.
The Million Pound Radio Show was written and presented by Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel with Felicity Montague and Jasper Jacobs. It was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.